Does America still have a big heart? Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The suspect in the Pittsburgh synagogue attack reportedly hated a Jewish nonprofit called Hias. That group's core mission? To help resettle refugees.
We hear their stories today, and they're no different than our parents' stories, our grandparents' stories. They're seeking the same things that we did and are finding it here in the U.S. Safety and hope and a chance at a future.
Also, Chinese dissident artist Ai Weiwei is here in the U.S. right now. So what's his take on the current mood?
The reality is about how U.S. as a nation still have power to accept the difference and have the big heart.
Ai Weiwei and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. The news from Pittsburgh is as shocking today as it was on Saturday, and why shouldn't it be? 11 people murdered inside a synagogue, 6 more injured. According to the Anti-Defamation League, it's believed to be the deadliest attack on the Jewish community in the history of the United States. The man accused with carrying out that attack is now facing federal hate crime charges, among others, charges that could lead to the death penalty. We're also learning more about the suspected gunman, his trail of anti-Semitic posts on social media, for example. Those posts included some that targeted Hias, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society. It's an organization that provides aid and assistance for refugees of all backgrounds and religions. Melanie Nezer is Senior Vice President with Hias. If you don't mind, Melanie, let me just start with your reaction to the attack. What were your initial thoughts when you heard about the shooting, and also when you learned that the man charged with the shooting had referenced Hias, your organization, on social media?
Well, hearing about the shooting as a Jewish person and as an American, you know, kind of, while not surprising, was still shocking. So trying to process that information and to hear about this deadly attack on a synagogue was the first shock that we got this weekend. And then just about a half hour later, having received the information about the tweet about Hias, honestly, we're still processing that.
I mean, the tweet, I'm not sure if it was on Twitter, but the man charged with the attack wrote on a social media platform, "Hias likes to bring invaders in that kill our people. I can't sit by and watch my people get slaughtered. Screw your optics. I'm going in." I mean, that is really eerie.
That statement contains so much misinformation that I think people really need to understand what Hias and other refugee resettlement agencies do and what our role is in this country. The U.S. government brings in refugees. The U.S. government identifies people abroad. There are 25 million refugees around the world, 65 million displaced people overall. That's the highest level in recorded history. And the U.S. government offers safety to a tiny fraction of those people. And then agencies like Hias and other national resettlement agencies, most of which are faith-based, and our local partners, we're the ones who meet them at the airport and take them home and make sure that their refrigerator has food in it and make sure that their kids get enrolled in schools. We make sure that they are connected with employers. So that's the work that we do. We don't bring them here. We welcome them. We hear their stories today, and they're no different than our parents' stories, our grandparents' stories, you know, our relatives' stories. They're seeking the same things that we did and are finding it here in the U.S., safety and hope and a chance at a future.
Yeah, give us a little more information about the history of Hias. It's been around for more than 100 years. How did it all start?
Well, we started in the 1880s. It was a Jewish organization that literally went down to the docks at Ellis Island to help newer Jewish refugees and immigrants. We were working with Jewish refugees because there were so many. It wasn't until about 20 years ago that we had a decision to make. We decided that once we were an organization that helped refugees because they were Jewish, and now we help refugees because we are Jewish, because we have a connection and a real empathy to refugees and people who are persecuted for what they believe and who they are. So we decided that those stories are no different than our stories, and that people fleeing persecution today deserve the same chance that people did before when they were offered it in this country.
Are there non-Jews who've been kind of resettled into the U.S. by Hias who are wondering what is going on? Have you heard those kind of questions?
Well, what we've heard more is what can we do to help? you resettled us, you helped us, you brought us here. What can we do to help? And, you know, sadly, what we're also hearing is this our fault? Because you helped us, is this our fault? And I think the answer to that is a resounding no. They've done everything that they're supposed to do. They, you know, they've come in through the refugee program. They've started their lives again. And now all they want to do is help. And, you know, it's, they've found sanctuary here where they can worship, where they can express their beliefs, where they can associate with the people that they want to. So for them, this is a sanctuary. And I don't think this really changes that. But of course, everybody's worried about where this could go.
With the rhetoric from the president and the reception some of his tweets are getting with people like the alleged attacker in Pittsburgh, as well as the alleged bomb maker last week, where do you sit in the middle of all this rhetoric and how do you deal with it?
Well, I think the only way that we deal with it is to stand up to it. I think that what we've learned time and time again, and particularly this weekend, is that hate speech can lead to hate action and violence, and we can't give it a pass anymore. That's really our only weapon. We need to stand up and fight against hate and make sure we don't give any of it a pass anymore, because the consequences can be so tragic.
Melanie Nezer, the Senior Vice President for Public Affairs of HIAS, thank you very much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Will Carlos covers extremism for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. He's based in Brazil, where there is another big story today, the election of far-right candidate Jair Bolsonaro as president. More on that later. First, I asked Will how the Pittsburgh synagogue attack fits in with his reporting on extremism in America.
Obviously, it's a particularly violent episode. I mean, we do see anti-Semitism really ramping up over the last couple of years, really, you know, following the election of President Donald Trump. You see awful amounts of anti-Semitism on social media, on right-wing social media, but also on mainstream social media like Facebook and Twitter. And so, you know, it's not particularly surprising. I mean, this isn't the first guy to walk into a synagogue or a Jewish center and start shooting people. And sadly, I don't think that he'll be the last. But the scale of this attack was worse than anything we've seen, at least in recent years.
I know it can be difficult to connect violence to political rhetoric, but looking at events like the mail bombs last week and the synagogue shooting, to what extent can you make that link? Because we got to remember Dylann Roof went into a Charleston, South Carolina church and killed people there before the election of Trump.
Yeah, I don't find it difficult to make that link at all. I mean, you've got President Donald Trump retweeting and spreading completely false anti-Semitic theories about George Soros, the Hungarian Jewish multi-billionaire, saying that he's, you know, funding everything from the caravan of migrants who's making their way to the southern border to protesters. And, you know, that trickles down. That trickles down. We see, for example, the Pittsburgh shooter on his Gab social media account in the days leading up to the shooting was posting about George Soros. A Trump mega fan sent a pipe bomb allegedly to George Soros' home. So I think there are clear connections, and I think the media just needs to stop dancing around this subject and just lay it out very clearly. The president is spreading malicious rumors, and that's trickling down to his fan base, and people are going out and killing people. It's as simple as that.
So you mentioned this social media site Gab, and we've heard a lot about it since the shooting in Pittsburgh. Tell us more about Gab. What do you know?
They're basically an alt-right Twitter. I mean, that's the way to think about them. Now, their shtick is that they're all about free speech. And the reality is that it's a collection of neo-Nazis, racists, anti-Semites, people who like to get on and spread mostly fake nonsense about Jews, about people of color. And I mean, I think most people would be absolutely appalled by most of the content on there.
I mean, they've been shut down, but won't the people who go to Gab, won't they just go somewhere else to find a like-minded community?
Yeah, this is a tricky debate that's been going on for some time now. You know, to what extent is it efficacious to deplatform these guys, to shut down their places of congregation? But I mean, I kind of think that that misses the point. I mean, ultimately, the people who host Gab, they're a private company run by individuals like you and me. And if they don't want to host people who are spreading hateful stuff, then that's their prerogative. These guys are not being censored. It's not as if a government body or entity is coming in and saying, hey, you guys can't spread your message. They'll find someone else to host them. I think we just have to acknowledge that every time a Republican congressman, you know, retweets a conspiracy theory, they make these people feel as if they're legitimate, as if what they're saying is true. And that's something that 5 years ago didn't really exist. You know, these people lived on the fringes and were treated as outcasts. And today they're being legitimized by mainstream politicians and in some cases by the president himself.
Well, let's turn to Brazil now. I mean, you've got an interesting perspective on extremism, covering hate in the U.S. and living in Brazil, especially now that there's been this election yesterday that led to a victory for populist right-wing candidate Jair Bolsonaro. What parallels do you see between Bolsonaro and Donald Trump?
I actually think that the parallels have been overblown because I think Jair Bolsonaro makes Donald Trump look like Mr. Rogers. He says openly homophobic things. He once said that he would rather his son were dead than gay. I mean, he's told a female congresswoman on the floor of the National Congress that he didn't think she was worth raping because she was basically not attractive enough for him. I mean, this is a guy who is very open about his hateful speech and who has also, we've seen, added fuel to the fire of racism and misogyny and especially anti-journalism violence in Brazil over the last few months. A Brazilian investigative journalism organization has tracked at least 50 hate-fueled crimes committed by Jair Bolsonaro supporters across the country. There's certainly political violence connected to Jair Bolsonaro.
So what is the mood like in Brazil this day after the election there?
Honestly, the mood is pretty jubilant. I mean, especially in the neighborhood that I live in. Brazil, like America, is very divided right now. You've got the northwest and to some extent the northeast of Brazil, the sort of more rural areas that really didn't support Jair Bolsonaro and came out in favor of the People's Party. And then you've got the southeast where most Brazilians live in megacities like Rio and São Paulo, and they heavily supported Jair Bolsonaro. The crowd outside Jair Bolsonaro's house last night had, I would say, equal numbers of Afro-Brazilians and white Brazilians. It surprises a lot of people who don't fully understand the political dynamics here, me included. You know, I mean, I'm not Brazilian, and I look at some of the things that Jair Bolsonaro said, and I think, you know, how can Afro-Brazilians support him? How can the LGBT community support him? But if you talk to those people, basically what it is that other considerations, primarily security, primarily the crime situation in Brazil, sort of outweighs anything else. And if you think about it, Marco, the neighborhoods which are disproportionately affected by crime are the favelas, neighborhoods which are also disproportionately Afro-Brazilian. And these are the people who desperately want their lives to become safer. And that's what Jair Bolsonaro is promising them. And people buy that and it sort of overrules any other considerations they have. Most of the Brazilians that I speak to, there's either total apathy, they're just so completely given up on the Brazilian political system and think that you just got to help yourself, or they have a level of hope that at least something will change with Jair Bolsonaro.
Well, Carlos, who covers hate and extremism for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, speaking with us from Rio de Janeiro. Will, thanks very much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Brazilian musician Caetano Veloso connecting his country and the U.S. This is Manhattan, his song imagining the pre-Columbian island of New York City. The canoes slowly going down the river to a place, go the lyrics, where all the people of the world turn their gaze.
Sente-se o gosto do vento cantando nos vidros o nome doce da cunha.
My conversation with Ai Weiwei, that's next, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, this is The World. We've been talking immigration and free speech today, two things our next guest, Chinese dissident artist Ai Weiwei, has also been talking about as he prepares to move back to a city he once called home, New York.
The reality is about how U.S. as a nation still have power. to accept the difference, still have energy or still young enough to take the challenge and have a vision and have the big heart.
But what if that American heart grows smaller, asks Ai Weiwei. We'll get to that in a few minutes. Ai Weiwei's name became well known here in the West after he was targeted by the Chinese government for his activism. Before that, he was working in relative obscurity in Beijing in the mid-90s and for some years in New York City. Ai looks back on those years now as an important season in his life.
If you talk about the winter, then you come to spring, you come to summer. More and more I treasure those times.
His new book captures some of those times. It's called Ai Weiwei, Beijing Photographs, 1993 to 2003. In several photos, he documents the final days of his father, Ai Qing, one of China's finest modern poets, and an artist who, like his son, felt the wrath of Chinese authorities.
After he passed away, you feel you're alone, and you don't belong to anybody, and maybe that's a moment you want to act. So that's really a psychologically preparation for me to become a new boss of myself.
A new boss of yourself?
Yes. It's like a Godfather film.
So I'd like you, if you would, tell us a story of the preparations for his memorial after your father died in 1996, because Chinese officials had their own ideas about how that event should really unfold, right?
Yes, this is a communist society. Everything have a clear hierarchy, you know. So he was kicked out from the Communist Party. Even he was the same generation as the state leaders, Chairman Mao, Zhou Enlai, all those people. They were together. But he was heavily criticized as a rightist, you know, somewhere against the party.
So your father was in that inner circle with Mao?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
They're really core, which supported the revolution, or part of the revolution. But later, of course, he'd been kicked out from the party as anti-revolution and spent about 20 years in exile, not allowed to write her words. His name totally disappeared in the public.
So the memorial, how did that...
The memorial, first they decided his body has to be covered by a communist flag. It's very high honor, and that means you're part of this revolution. But I feel completely uncomfortable. You know, I said, you know, you should not do something to somebody already passed away, which, you know, is made against his will. So I made that argument. I said, we don't need to cover that flag.
Did they resist?
Yeah, they told me, they said, your father doesn't just belong to your family. You know, which is a very good argument. They say everything belongs to the Communist Party or state.
Was it a convincing argument, though?
No, it's not. For me, it's insulting to someone and has suffered so much, then later being covered by that piece of red blanket with this hammer and how do you call that?
Sickle.
Sickle,
yeah.
On it. For me, it's brutal. It hurts me.
And then there were the flowers.
Flowers, in this kind of ceremony, they all use the same set of paper flowers, you know. If someone used them the next day.
A week later, somebody dies.
Same. Wow. I walk in that room, I feel, no, we don't need to use anything being used before. So they say, what are you going to do? I said, I will buy the fresh flowers. My father is a poet, he's an artist, you know. His life was so much related to the highest aesthetic judgment and moral judgment. So I said, I have to change it. So we sent out our people to bought all the white flowers in Beijing City.
Wow.
And then we made a fresh flower bed so he can sleep in the middle, but still covered by this red blanket.
While your father was ill, you did this performance. That's all I can call it. You intentionally smashed a Qing Dynasty porcelain and a Han Dynasty urn, and you were photographed smashing another urn. How did these ideas come to you, especially while your father was dying?
It's not really much ideas. It's really attitude or some kind of stupid, ridiculous action. You see child do that kind of thing all the time.
Was your intention to shake up the Chinese public?
No, it's not possible. You have no platform. The rest of society is in deep sleep. They don't care.
It was interesting something you said about smashing the vase. You felt it was almost like a child acting out. And I want to ask you about the middle finger, because it's a photographic motif that you've used, pointing your finger at the Hong Kong skyline, pointing your middle finger at the Eiffel Tower, Chairman Mao. I felt like when I saw this, it's like a rebellious teenager who's just gotten a camera for the first time. What is up with the finger?
It's just as you said, as a rebellious teenager, now I realize I don't do that anymore because I may grow older, you know. And as individual in this society, what else can you do? I mean, it's just give out your opinions.
So you spent a lot of time in the United States. Do you feel you can still count on the U.S. to be kind of the beacon of free expression around the world?
I don't really think that way. You know, on the surface, on the shallow surface, yes, U.S. Defending individual rights or human rights. But deeply, U.S. also causing a lot of problem for other people, for other nations, for broader human rights violations.
I mean, I ask partly because you live in Berlin now, but I understand you're moving to New York with your family, correct?
Yes.
So I know you've described the U.S. as a country of immigrants, which I think a lot of people would agree with, but President Donald Trump seems to reject that idea. How do you feel about this reality as you are about to move to the U.S.?
I think the reality is about how U.S. as a nation still have power to accept the difference, still have energy or still young enough to take the challenge and have a vision and have the big heart. So if they don't, then they will push people away, they'll blame other people, and it just shows the weakness.
And if that big heart starts to shrink while you're here, are you going to turn your eye and your critiques toward the United States, or at least make your critiques in your art of China more universal and maybe applying to the U.S.?
I always protect the basic rights of freedom of speech and human rights. I don't see that only as a Chinese problem. It's a universal problem.
Ai Weiwei, thank you very much for your time. It was an honor and a great pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Check out my selfie with Ai Weiwei. And the really cool thing about it, Ai Weiwei took it because, you know, skill. You can see it at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Permafrost is that deep layer of always frozen earth in the Arctic. Well, not always. And that's a problem for all of us.
The amount of carbon that's stored in here is twice the amount that we have in the atmosphere. And so if that would all be released into the atmosphere, that would mean a huge climatic change for sure.
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Science tells us that burning fossil fuels is a key contributor to climate change. That puts pressure on the giant oil companies that provide the fossil fuels. Or it should. A lawsuit filed last week against ExxonMobil alleges they defrauded shareholders by downplaying the climate change threat to its bottom line. Jeff Colgan is a professor at Brown University. He specializes in energy and environmental policy. What exactly is ExxonMobil being accused of, Jeff?
Well, they're specifically being accused of deceiving the investors in the extent to which climate change might hurt the profitability of ExxonMobil's business. But of course, that's related to a larger story about how ExxonMobil's public relations campaigns have deceived the public about climate change. ExxonMobil was instrumental in some of the campaigns led by the American Petroleum Institute, which is the kind of industry lobby group in the 1990s that set out specific goals to try to get the public to recognize uncertainty, to see climate change as an uncertain issue where there wasn't clarity around the science of it. And that was very much inconsistent with what ExxonMobil's own scientists were saying, where they were saying, look, the science is settled, and we understand that climate change is coming and it's caused by humans.
What has ExxonMobil been saying in its defense?
Well, ExxonMobil has changed its tune over time. When the CEO was Lee Raymond in 2000, he was very much opposed to the idea of global warming. He, in fact, even said publicly that he feared a coming ice age more than he feared catastrophic warming. So he had a really kind of tough line on climate change. Since then, things have changed. So when Rex Tillerson, who later became the Secretary of State, when Tillerson became the CEO, ExxonMobil changed its tune and they started to withdraw funding from the groups that had been denying the science of climate change that Exxon had been funding in the 1990s and early 2000s.
Presumably this lawsuit focuses on those earlier days. Is there a smoking gun, like a memo where higher-ups at the company said at one point, look, this is our plan?
Well, that's interesting because the New York Attorney General has been requesting internal documents, and we don't know what all of those documents say, but the Deputy Attorney General has said exactly those words that you just said, smoking guns, plural. So we don't know what the text of that is, but it sounds like the prosecutors are confident that ExxonMobil did deceive its shareholders.
So ExxonMobil's all over the globe. Is this the New York Attorney General's office acting alone, or have they been hearing from interested parties all over the globe?
The New York State Attorney General is, of course, very powerful because the New York Stock Exchange is governed by New York state law. And so other parties have been weighing in, including other states, and presumably other countries are going to be watching this case very closely.
Jeff Colgan, professor at Brown University, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Despite what Exxon might have suggested, the big picture science of climate change has been clear for years. Carbon dioxide and other kinds of pollution from human activity help trap more heat in the atmosphere. That warms up the planet. There is uncertainty, though, about some of the details, things like how all that warming is affecting the natural systems of the Earth. Permafrost, for example, the freezer of the planet. And you know what it's like when you leave your freezer door open for a while. The Arctic is the freezer we're looking at. The world is focusing on the Arctic and climate change in a bunch of stories produced with the podcast Threshold and its host, Amy Martin. Today, Amy heads to northern Sweden with researchers looking at some of the big questions about permafrost.
I'm sitting in the middle of a rowboat in northern Sweden. It's a lovely summer day. There are flocks of birds circling around me in the sky. And I'm just sitting there like a tourist in Venice.
Who knew that climate change research could be so much fun?
We have so much fun in the boat when me and Jenny go out.
That's Matilda Nisal. She and Jenny Goling trade off doing the rowing. They're master's students at Stockholm University, and they're studying Arctic permafrost, soil that's been frozen all year round for at least 2 years. They're measuring the gases that permafrost releases when it thaws, as it's starting to do, because these are some of the same gases that help to warm up the climate. Joachim Janssen is leading this project. He's working on his PhD at the same school.
We are looking at the methane gas bubbling from the lake sediment into the atmosphere.
Usually, when we talk about climate warming emissions, we're thinking of the stuff coming out of our cars or smokestacks. But all around the Arctic, in beautiful places like this, powerful greenhouse gases are starting to escape into the atmosphere, and they're coming from permafrost.
The amount of carbon that's stored in here is twice the amount that we have in the atmosphere. And so if that would all be released into the atmosphere, that would mean a huge climatic change for sure.
When you say the amount of carbon we have stored here is twice what's in the atmosphere, you mean the amount of carbon we have in the Arctic?
Yeah, just in Arctic permafrost.
Just in Arctic permafrost?
Permafrost soils, yeah.
Wow.
This is a statistic worth remembering, so let me put it another way. Take all the carbon currently floating around in the atmosphere and put it in one bucket, then scoop up all of the carbon currently frozen in Arctic permafrost, and it would fill two buckets of the same size. Not far away from the lake, Geisho Blumaveri is stabbing the soil with a long metal pole.
It's called a permafrost probe. So this is a steel rod. So this gives us an indication of how much of the soil is frozen or not frozen.
Geisha is an ecosystem ecologist, and she's been researching Arctic plants here in Abisko, Sweden, for the last 6 years. She hasn't pushed the probe into the soil very far at all before it hits something. Something that sounds like a big rock.
This is not a stone. This is frozen soil.
She pulls the probe back out.
And then if you touch this...
Wow!
It's really, really cold.
That's a trip.
In just a few seconds, the end of the pole has become so cold that it's uncomfortable to touch. It's almost eerie, like it picked up a message for us from a hidden world right under our feet, the world of permafrost. It can be anywhere from a meter to a kilometer thick. It can be very, very cold or just barely frozen. And all around the Arctic, it's starting to thaw. You might have seen some of the pictures, roads that are sinking and buckling, homes shifting and cracking, and trees tilting at awkward angles, giving rise to the label drunken forests. In fact, there's a line of telephone poles next to the meadow where Geisha and I are standing, and one of them looks a little drunken too.
That one that is kind of tilting now, that is probably standing in an area where the permafrost is just disappearing now, so they will have to redo that soon.
For people who live in the Arctic, these changes are a really big deal. In many northern cultures, cellars cut into the permafrost have been a reliable way to store food. It becomes nature's freezer. Now, people can't always trust that their food won't spoil. And thawing permafrost affects all of the newer kinds of infrastructure, too. Not only buildings, but water mains, sewage drains, even cemeteries. Communities are scrambling to adapt as the ground literally shifts beneath them. But Geisha says permafrost is important to all of us, no matter where we live, because it's providing a globally important service, keeping carbon out of the atmosphere, free of charge.
So the permafrost that we have here was formed probably during the last ice age, so like 11,000 years or so ago. And that material in the permafrost is that old. Like it is made up out of plant material from plants that used to grow at that time.
And the remains of dead animals are in this soil, too. Not fossilized bones or petrified wood, the actual stuff. And all of this organic material has a lot of carbon in it. In fact, that's what the word organic means. Organic chemistry is carbon chemistry. So when Geisha says this soil has a lot of dead plants in it, she means...
We've put our carbon in the freezer.
Yeah, we have. And now we're unfortunately kind of taking the plug out of the freezer and it's starting to thaw.
And so then once permafrost starts to truly thaw, then carbon just kind of comes, like, how does the carbon get from down there to up into the atmosphere?
Because microbes are eating it and they are respiring, so they are breathing, basically, and then they emit carbon.
So it's microbe breath that we have to worry about.
Yeah, basically.
Microbes. When living things die, microbes begin breaking them down, and the carbon that was locked up in a blade of grass or the horn of a bison gets liberated and floats up into the atmosphere as methane or carbon dioxide. Freezing slows microbes down, but it doesn't kill them. Thawing speeds them back up. Back at the lake, Matilda rows us up close to a big funnel floating upside down in the water. It has a big syringe fitted onto the skinny end, sticking up. These little contraptions look pretty homemade, because they are.
The way we make them float is by using pool noodles, things you would use in the swimming pool.
So you take your funnel, turn it upside down, wrap a piece of pool noodle around the wide part, and put a plastic syringe on the top, and you've got yourself a little trap designed to capture gases bubbling up from the lake below. Matilda rows us up to another trap, and Joachim reaches over the side of the boat with a syringe in his hand.
So he's pulling out the gas.
What'd you find there?
So we have about 7 milliliters of gas. So this used to be in the lake sediment, where it formed a bubble, and that bubble traveled through the water into our trap, and now it's in the syringe.
They've likely captured a mixture of gases.
Most of which will likely be methane. But we're not sure, so we take these to the lab and then we measure the actual methane concentration.
Methane is a powerful greenhouse gas. And these scientists have 40 of these bubble traps on this lake and a bunch more nearby. They check all of them multiple times a week, all summer long. And this is all just to understand how much methane is coming off this one small area this year under these particular conditions. Groups of scientists are at work around the Arctic, studying sites that are wetter or drier, colder or warmer, with more or less vegetation. And they're all trying to understand just how quickly these billions of tons of carbon might be released.
I think the scary part is that we don't know what an extra 4 degrees of warming will do to this huge amount of carbon that's stored here in the permafrost. We are trying to actively to figure that out.
Joachim says it's hard to accurately assess greenhouse emissions from Arctic soil because the whole system is so complex. But it's also hard because humans have never warmed the planet up like we are now. We have nothing to compare this to. At least from our species' perspective, we're in what climate scientists call a no-analog situation, a massive global experiment.
There's a knob that we turn on that big Arctic permafrost machine that we don't know what it does. And until we actually figure out what it does, it may be a good idea to stop turning the knob.
If you have a warming of 1 degree, that makes all the difference in the world because it gets from frozen to thawed. And that is something that us scientists are really worried about because there are many thresholds that you might cross there.
Geisha Blumaberry says that in many parts of the Arctic, the permafrost has already thawed enough to start emitting carbon. And in other places, the frozen soil is right on the cusp of that pivot point, where a change of 1 or 2 degrees can transform it from being something that stores carbon to something that emits it.
We might tip the scales of these really large exchanges. Then it can have really dramatic consequences. It's not about saving the polar bear. I think a lot of people, when they think about climate change, they're like, yeah, you know, some plants will disappear, the polar bear, yeah, I mean, it's cute, but it's also about, like, us surviving as a species, because if it gets much warmer, like, the way that we have evolved with our agriculture and how we, like, the food that we eat and where we live is just not adapted to that.
We don't know how close we are to a massive release of carbon from frozen Arctic soils, but we do know that every bit of carbon we emit into the atmosphere gets us closer to that point. Scientists call it a positive feedback loop. More carbon in the air leads to more warming, which leads to the release of more carbon, and the process just builds on itself. Another thing we know is that we don't get a second chance at this. Once our emissions potentially trigger this huge release of carbon, we've put ourselves at the mercy of processes that we can't control and that will dramatically reshape the Earth's climate and our own civilizations. I asked Joachim if he thought there was any way to stop this experiment we're conducting on the Arctic, or if he thought the damage was already done, and now we just have to ride it out.
No, we have an ability to say stop. Of course we do. We have choices, and I think especially in the Western world, in the rich world, we have choices and therefore we have a responsibility. And one of the ways is to try and understand this experiment better. And that's my part, that's what we do here. And the other part is acting on what we already know, which is stop putting so much greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. Yeah, I think we have a responsibility and I think we can act.
For the world, Amy Martin, Abisko, Sweden.
Amy's reporting comes to us through our partnership with the Threshold podcast and radio program with funding support from the Pulitzer Center. You can check out the rest of Amy's stories at theworld.org/thebigmelt. Yeah, you know, our hometown Red Sox are World Series champs once again. Unforgettable season for the Sox and their rookie manager, Alex Cora. He started the season by getting the Red Sox to help with hurricane relief for his hometown of Caguas, Puerto Rico. And the people of Puerto Rico were on his mind last night after the team sealed the World Series.
I asked for a plane for supplies for my hometown, and now I'm just asking for the whole team or the majority of them to fly home with that trophy and enjoy it with my countrymen.
Among those who've been writing Cora's praises for this record-setting season is Michael Collazo. He wrote a story for Latino Rebels titled Why Boston Red Sox Manager Alex Cora Deserves All the Accolades for a World Series Victory. Alex Cora stepped up to the trophy presentation last night, and almost the first words out of his mouth were Puerto Rico. What does this win mean for him and the island?
What first struck me about his attempt to, you know, shove PR into the Puerto Rico in the conversation was, I think, particularly a Puerto Rican athlete's historical memory of Roberto Clemente, who was a legend on the island and one of the great baseball players in the history of the game, who in 1971 won the World Series for the Pittsburgh Pirates, was a huge component of that win, and made it a point to actually speak in Spanish and to mention the island of Puerto Rico. So I think someone like him really has this sort of baseball historic memory of, this is my opportunity on a national stage to mention the island, particularly in the context of post-Hurricane Maria. So there's a lot of thinking, man, you know, we don't have a lot of bright spots, particularly in maybe local or national media context. So someone like Alex, who did an extraordinary job and led a team that performed historically well, means something, you know, even on a small level.
Do you think the disaster of Hurricane Maria did something to Cora's psyche, and how did that motivate him?
Someone like Alex, who has trying to been knocking on the door for a big MLB coaching or front office related role, I think that was motivation enough. He really had every element of experience that you would possibly could get to get a job like that. General manager in winter ball, World Baseball Classic. I played in the big leagues. I played in college ball. I was a bench coach in Houston with an analytics-driven organization. He did everything he possibly could. But there's no question, just I would think from an emotional family standpoint, and the fact that he really grew up in Caguas around winter ball. And he just probably has that emotional drive, you know, the sort of post-Maria, let me be a shining light sort of component to his drive there.
You know, we tend to think of Red Sox Nation as being in Boston, and then once you get outside of 128-95, it starts to get more diffuse. Should we consider Puerto Rico a key part of Red Sox Nation?
From my humble experience, family being huge baseball fans over the generations, it usually came down to a player someone really loved that tended to be from the island. So, for instance, you might meet Puerto Ricans that were historically Pirates fans because of Clemente. But the other component would be, I would argue, people that had family or grew up just loving a team for X reasons. So the fact that Alex Cora is manager of one of the historically successful franchises in the league and had an historically successful season his first time around, you know, maybe you do get a few more Bo Sox fans who didn't, of course, grow up in Roxbury or didn't grow up in Lawrence or somewhere like that. But maybe you get a few more that embrace Red Sox Nation because of his success.
It feels so significant, this championship for Cora, in so many ways. You mentioned how he's a role model just as a Puerto Rican for other Puerto Ricans. But how do you see his career influencing the game for other Latino players or potential managers?
Yeah, I think what jumped out to me was the fact that, again, he worked so hard to get every point in his resume to line up for a role like this. So his stint at ESPN, he was a bench coach for the Houston Astros. Folks who know baseball, Jeff Lunau is the GM there, came from corporate America, very analytics driven, not from a traditional, you know, I coached in the minors, I played in pro ball sort of track. So he had the traditional track, but really worked on getting the media experience track, the analytics track. And I think those elements together, Alex can be a tremendous role model for Latinos from all different sort of ethnic, economic backgrounds in their introduction to the pro game, on what all components you could put together to put yourself in a position and get a job like that.
Michael Collazo, a veteran sports writer. He's also president of the ticket brokerage firm Dade.com. Thanks very much for being here, Michael.
No, a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Hey, America, we're doing our best not to gloat today up here in Boston, but some celebratory music is in order. It's not just celebratory. This is one of your mood music requests, #WorldMoodMusic. It comes to us from Nikolai Lido, who catches the world on KQED in San Francisco. This is a tune called Dinsendeni from the South African band The Dahlem Kids. Lido says it is a bright and cheery way to start the day. I often play it, he says, for my kids at breakfast. Given that the song was written in 1991 South Africa, Lido told us, it's also a reminder that things will get better, which is often necessary these days. I heard about the Dahlem Kids from the Quartz Africa Weekly Update, says Lido, so I can't take too much credit. It's all good, Nikolai. We give you the credit for making the request. So what is your mood, and what is your mood music? We're taking requests, and the request Twitter feed is open. Tweet your mood music at me. I'm at Marco Werman. Again, hashtag World Mood Music. You can also share your mood music on our Instagram. We're at PRI The World. Today's music to adjust the mood, courtesy of South Africa's Dahlem Kids, and Nikolai Lido in San Francisco, who requested the track. Let us know your mood music suggestion, and we'll try to get it on the air. That'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.